Hi, I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass podcast, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, I encourage you to check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books. They're $10 paperback, $2.99 ebook download, including my bestseller and latest, NYPD Laughing in the Line of Duty. Speaking of books and authors, today's guest is a former NYPD sergeant turned author. He's worked in such units as the Missing Persons Unit, the Internal Affairs Bureau. He was drafted there, guys. We'll get into that. And he's just written a great book, All in a Day's Work, An Officer's Accounts, 20 Years, NYPD. And his name is John Fariso. John, welcome to the show, and how are you doing today?
Vic, I'm doing great, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, no, pleasure's mine, man. I love it that cops are writing books now. Tell us a little something about yourself and your book.
Yeah, I grew up in Queens, New York, and I grew up in a neighborhood that a lot of cops turned out of this area in Queens. I had family on the job. My uncle was a cop. My cousin was a cop. So I kind of knew what I was doing at a young age. And, you know, a lot of my friends became cops, so We used to see the cops in the neighborhood driving around, and I was always wondering what those guys were doing. And I would see the cars, and I would say, what are they in those cars talking about? I know they're talking about something important. I would find out years later they weren't, but I wrote about that. And I would watch them drive by. I lived in a great neighborhood, but it was still New York City.
What precinct?
104.
Okay.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, when I was a little kid, I know you talked about this, and the Son of Sam investigation was big in my neighborhood because that guy had killed three people walking distance from my house. And we were, you know, growing up, we were told, you know, you don't sit, you stay on the stoop, and when it gets dark, you come inside. It doesn't matter that he was attacking women. And
right.
And what's funny is, you know, I would read the newspapers as a little kid, and I would see these horrible crime scenes in the newspaper. And I would watch the news, and my parents never once said, John, you know, maybe you shouldn't be reading the newspaper or watching these crime scenes. I'm 7 years old watching this. And I remembered when they caught him, and I was amazed at what the detectives did. I knew about the gun in the car and all that, and I knew that he had killed three people in my neighborhood. So I was very intrigued by police work at a young age, and my dad would take me to cop movies, and we would take me to the R-rated movies, and, yep, you know, Fort Apache, The Bronx, Serpico, all those movies. We sat there and we watched them, and, you know, even the cop shows I would watch. I watched Barney Miller. You know, Hill Street Blues was my favorite. Oh, yeah. And I remember that piano in the beginning of that, watching that on my little TV, and I knew at a young age, I said, I'm going to be a cop. And I would say it. I would say, I'm going to be a police officer one day. And being that I was an okay student, college was not really, even though I went and did my schooling, it was like, I think everybody knew I was going to be a city worker. If I didn't become a cop, I would be breaking concrete in the bad weather somewhere.
What got you into writing after your career? Like, what was that moment where you said, you know what, I can write a book, I should write a book, and did you have any hesitation about writing the book?
I had a hesitation at a young age. What happened was, like I said, I wasn't a good student. So this is way before computers. If you have a younger audience, you know, maybe they need to know that, you know, pencil to paper was how you did it. Or you had a typewriter that made this annoying sound over and over again. And even if you made a mistake on a typewriter, it was a mistake. You know, it looked terrible. So I got very intimidated. But as a little kid, I was like, I watched you remember the Bad News Bears, that movie? Oh, yeah. I was like, that's me and my friends. That's us. I could write this and write that movie. So I thought about it, and I used to write it down, and it was terrible. So later on, when I actually didn't read much, but when I went to college, I was able to read what I wanted to read. And I always picked up true crime, law enforcement, anything police-related. So I would read these stories, and I said, I knew I was becoming a cop, even in college. I said, this is what I'm going to do. And I actually knew I was going to be writing before I was even on the job. I used the term on the job because I know you know, so you've explained that. So I was going to get on the job, and I was going to write. And at that time, I was working at a sports bar, and it was so quiet. And I said to myself, why would I want to work a job that I can't write about? So I said, you know, police officers, there's very few professions that you can write about and people are interested in. I can't think of too many. And police is really up there. And even people, whether they don't like the cops, they like them, or they have no interest in being a cop, they're interested in reading about it. True crime and all that. So I said to myself, when I become a cop, I'm going to start writing immediately. And I'm talking, I went in the academy, and I would come home at night, and I would take out my spiral notebook, and I would start writing it down.
And a head start on me.
Yeah. I would put the cop humor in. I would put it all in. I would say, today, we ran around the gym, and someone forgot their lock. And I would write these long things, and there was no police work in it yet, and none of the academy stuff made it to the book, but it got me started. And then, when I went to the precinct, I was getting hit with, police work within the first week. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I got to start writing like now. So I would, after the incident, I had these little cue cards, and I would, I had carried a big bag with me. So my coworkers had no clue what I was doing.
Are you one of those guys that carried the briefcase or the bag and the radio card?
Well, not really in the radio card. What happened was we had Elmhurst Hospital, and they used to stick us with these horrible prisoners.
What precinct did you work in?
The 110.
Okay.
So my first command was the 110 precinct. And I started reading because I was watching these prisoners, and it was like I was doing time. I actually had a prisoner come up to me and say, what are you reading? Because when I was doing my 3 years upstate, I read a lot. So the prisoners were actually looking at me like, oh, you're doing your time and I'm doing mine. So I would have these little cue cards and I would write it out. And there was times I had these wacky prisoners that were like, oh, this is bull. We had a guy who ate drugs and they had a surgery his stomach to get the drugs out. And he's yelling at me saying he wants to tell his side of the story. He needs to see the judge. And I'm like, yeah, great. Tell the judge. I don't know what you're going to tell him. So I would write all that down. And I didn't tell my coworkers because they would have gotten suspicious.
Because they think you have ulterior motives. They think you're going to jam them up. They think, yeah, I know it's a slippery slope when you're thinking about doing something like that, because everybody first thing is, what is this fucking guy writing about me?
Yeah, they're like, and I was also worried that I'm always thinking ahead. That's just me. I'm like, if they know I'm writing, they're going to like avoid me, and then they're not going to bring me on a job, and they're going to be like, oh, he's writing a book, stay away from him. So I didn't want to tell them.
Well, you know how it is in law enforcement. If you get labeled a rat or odd, especially when we first came on, I don't know about nowadays, it's almost like being shunned in the Amish. I mean, yes. I can speak about what happened in the Bronx. There were a couple of guys that went bad, and you'd go into a precinct and, like, don't talk to that fucking guy. Like, you'd have 30 guys in one end of the muster room getting ready for roll call, and there'd be one guy sitting there by himself, and no one – like, that guy would always get the rookies, or even, like, the bosses would have to put him on DOAs because no one wanted to work with the guy.
That's sad because I noticed that when I first got there. Like, I knew gossip, how the world works. Right. I grew up in New York City. And the first day I was there, the first day I'm in the locker room, a cop comes up to me, doesn't say hello or anything. He's like, hey, rookie, who's your training sergeant? And I told him, he goes, all right, he's okay. Make sure you don't have so-and-so. He's terrible. So I'm like, okay. So I walk away.
Like, you really had a say in that.
Yeah. And I walk away, and another guy comes up to me. He's like, who's your training sergeant? And he's like, good thing you don't have so-and-so. So I'm like, oh my gosh, these guys are brutal. And then I hear him downstairs bad-mashing the guy. And I knew that they were trying to get us to totally dislike this guy. And I was like, wow, man, that's some real 13th grade going on.
And, those are the guys, well, what are you putting in?
Yeah, speaking of that.
Speaking of that, I'm quoting your book. You said NYPD cops will get involved with more and witness more toxic events than the average person will see in a lifetime. Explain.
Well, like you always say, the front row seat to the greatest show on earth. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't think of any other profession. Well, maybe like an emergency room nurse or something that's really or someone who's gone off the wall. Someone who's going to deal with events that most people want nothing to do with. That we're going to deal with. You probably remember this in the academy. It's not done like this anymore because I have a family member on the job now, and I asked, and they were like, no, we don't do that. They took us to the morgue. Do you remember going to the morgue?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did a whole episode on that.
Yes. And they took us to the morgue, and I remembered watching an autopsy, and I saw some crazy stuff. And I was like, I knew I was going to see it, but when you see it, you're like... And then I leave the morgue, and it's lunchtime. So what am I going to do?
I forgot about that.
So, because they take in the morning. Lunch, and I'm like, I got this effing smell in my nose. What is it?
Yeah.
And then I go home and I'm like, you can't tell anybody because they're going to have no clue what you're talking about. And you shouldn't tell anybody because they're going to be like, you got to become a teacher. What are you doing? So then I get to the precinct, and the first day I was there, this is right after they were bad-mouthing this one guy. A couple of guys are like, hey, we're going to go get something to eat on the corner. And we were going through like an orientation. So I remember a guy going, who's wearing their vest? No, we're just going to the corner. Nobody wear their vest. So I don't even have my vest on. I go up, and if people know the 110, it gets very congested very quickly. When you get towards like Roosevelt Avenue area, it's like Manhattan congested. And a car screeches in front of me and stops right in front of me. And I'm like, you forget you're a cop. And the guy goes, this guy just pulled a gun on me. And I'm like, okay. And then the guy next to me is like, what happened? And the car pulls up and they're all staring at us. And gets out of the car, points at him. He goes, they have a gun in the car. He just pointed at me. And we're all standing there like, and we're forgetting we're actually our first day as cops. And we didn't even like, one guy maybe had the radio because we were only going to get something to eat. And my mind's going, you're not wearing your vest. You're not wearing your vest.
Right, right. You start thinking too much.
Yeah. And I'm like, wow. And then the car with the guys in it, they hit the gas and took off on us. And my mind is saying, oh, this is great. They left. I'm good. And the other guy's like, they're gone. Forget it. And we're like, and we all look at each other. And we're like, all right, let's go get lunch.
And probably the guys that got the gun pulled on them, they were dirtbags too. And they probably were like, you know what? I'm going to make a left and get out of here myself. It's funny, that mindset, when you come out of the police academy and you go into field training, or even after field training, but really just as you're in field training, you're still not a cop yet. You don't, like you just said, people come up to you and your mind isn't thinking. You're like steps behind. It takes a while to level out with the street and know immediately, you know, if that would have happened within a year or two, that guy would have been out of the car by his head, would have went right out the window, vest or no vest. But when you're a rookie cop, you don't have that. You're so afraid because it's 6 months of them telling you you're going to lose your job and don't do this and don't do that and God forbid you do this. And it's when you get around seasoned cops where you start realizing it's okay to do my job.
Yes, you're 100% correct about that. And your mindset is not there, but I learned quickly that there's dangerous people out there and you're going to run into dangerous situations. And I think like the first week is I was getting mixed up with all these different guys, and I would notice that I would ride with one guy and he's like, we're not doing nothing. You're not doing nothing. Don't answer the radio. Just sit there and watch. I'm like, okay. And I watched and I learned. And the next day I'm in the car with a guy's like, you're the rookie. You're going to learn. You're doing everything today. And I'm like, wow. Okay. I got two totally different personalities. And in one of those guys I worked with, you know, we were on Roosevelt Avenue again, and we get there and it's assault in progress. And you're like, they ran away. They're gone. And I get there and there's a guy holding his neck and it's like a pool of blood on the avenue. And I'm like, this guy might die right in front of me. I'm like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And this and that. And then actually the perp was still there. He never left. So another cop from another command grabbed the guy. And I'm like, wow, I almost just made an attempted murder call if this guy wasn't here. And the guy's holding his neck. And I'm saying to myself, all right, this guy's got to hold on. And then as he's holding his neck, I hear EMS in the back of my mind saying, okay, EMS is coming. They're going to take care of it. The guy's getting locked up. This guy's going to survive. And, you know, just 6 months prior, I was in the police academy. But a year prior to that, I'm waiting on tables in a sports bar. So I'm like, man, things like reality hit me quick. I was only 23 years old, and I'm dealing with these career criminals that have been doing this a lot longer than I was doing police work.
The 110, that's the precinct that, if you talk about Rosa, because I'm not a Queens guy, but that's the precinct that's under the L. You got all those South American bars. Great food, but during soccer season, man, there's a lot of assaults and stabbings underneath there. Because a couple of times we went to get something to eat and like, what the fuck? And we were in plain clothes and people are running up to us. We used to get a lot of tag cars out there. I was supposed to be in the Bronx and Manhattan, and when my lieutenant would go on vacation, there was just so many bad cars out in Queens. My partner used to say, he goes, it's like Vegas in the 70s. It's a wide open city. So we used to go out there and pick off a couple of tag cars over in Queens. And then Jackson Heights, right?
Yeah, Jackson Heights. We had the 110 and the 115 covered Jackson Heights. The Roosevelt Avenue was the border, but
that's a busy precinct. I mean, like you said, there's a lot going on. A lot of people don't realize the cocaine that comes into New York City back then would go into Jackson Heights. Basically, you've got stash houses with kilos. I mean, everybody thinks it's the Dominicans, but the Dominicans buy it off the Colombians. I don't know how it works now with the Mexicans now that they're trafficking, but in our time, Jackson Heights was like the place for cocaine. I mean, that was really literally cocaine cowboys in the early 90s.
Yeah, it definitely was. And in my book, I wrote a few stories about, I didn't do narcotics, but I came across heavy drugs at times and heavyweight and bad dudes that were involved in a lot of crazy stuff. And, you know, like I said a little earlier, we used to get the drug mules and they would go right to the 110 precinct area. And, you know, it opened my eyes up to a whole world of stuff that I assumed went on, but I never saw it directly till I got there.
In addition to the stash houses and the drug dealers out there, then you had another aspect of the drug trade. You had guys that would go to rip them off. So you had a lot of home invasions. And not only home invasions with the drug dealers, but sometimes they'd hit the wrong apartment or the wrong house. And they'd be terrorizing some family. Where is it? Where's the stash? Where's the safe? People don't, you know, I own a dry cleaner. I don't know what the hell you're talking about. And then they would start extorting legitimate people that own businesses because they thought that they were linked to drugs. You had a lot of money laundering, too, in that precinct. As I remember, you had a lot of places where telecommunicados, where you could call Columbia for like 4 hours for 99 cents. A lot of those businesses and a lot of the restaurants, not all, but a lot of them was set up to launder money. Clothes store. It was the same as Washington Heights. Clothing stores, telecommunications places, restaurants.
Yeah, those telecommunications places were funny. And anyone on the job in the 90s is going to remember this. Some of the countries, the area code was very close to 911. So they're in a some illegal place, and they're just calling their country, but they're calling 911. And I realize it. And after it happened like four times, I'm like, and I think the guy I was working with goes, oh, this happened again. What area code? And I even asked the guy, what country? I forgot the country. I go, what country are you calling? And what's the area code? And it was always very close to 911. But I can't think of how many times we blew up a spot accidentally. Because this
right. Because they're calling, they're trying to make a phone call, and they're calling the cops on themselves.
Yeah, and then they're just doing nothing on the phone, and the dispatcher's like 911 called this location, and you're like, this place is shady.
Did you now also in precincts like the 110, you had a lot of check cashing places, and what they would do is they would do money orders. So what the drug dealers would do is they can't get cash over the border, it's just too bulky. So what they would do is, and I don't, they keep changing it, but I think it was $5,000. As long as you had a money order at $5,000 or less, it didn't trip a flag. So you'd have, they were called Smurfs, and you'd have people with duffel bags full of cash, and they would go to check cashing place and get these $5,000, or I forget what the amount is, but get all these money orders and stacks of money orders and then mail them to whatever country. And my old partner worked in the El Dorado unit, and a couple of times, like, we'd be driving around a patrol and we'd go by a check cashing place and there'd be a car double parked. He goes, Smurfs. I go, how can you even tell? He goes, just the mannerisms, they're running in and out of the check cashing places. Yeah. So I'm sure you saw a lot of that with cash seizures and drug seizures.
Yeah, because they had vice unit there and they were involved in a lot. And they were always involved in something and they didn't really tell us. And when you're a rookie, you don't start just asking these guys with time on what they're doing. But you'd see the guys in the perps in the cells and you'd see the money and the cash machines, and there was definitely what you just mentioned going on, and that was just a 90s version of a crime at the time.
Did you ever come across any drug-related homicides?
Yes. You know, sometimes you don't know in the beginning, but I wrote in my book about one story when I had to take a body to the hospital. He was already gone, but I had to take it was a crime scene, and he was strangled in a car. And it was a crime scene, and I was the rookie. And by the time the crime scene was done with it, they put the body in the ambulance. And I'm riding in the ambulance, and there's a guy, you know, with wire around his neck sitting next to me in the ambulance. And I'm like, this ambulance is driving fast. It's turning. This thing could fall on me. And I'm like sitting in the ambulance, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. And then we went to the Queens morgue with it. But I went on other things where we would go to shots fired locations and you get to the apartment. And I had a guy once who he had been, this didn't make it to my book because it happened so fast. It was like 911 call down the block. We get there and there's a guy shot in the head and he's trying to talk to me, and I was trying to get out anything out of him I could, and he couldn't say anything. EMS showed up, took him out quick. I went to the hospital. The squad arrived. It happened so fast that, you know, he went DOA, but that was definitely, they told me later on, the detectives, what was going on in that apartment. It was some heavy stuff going on in that apartment, and it was all drug related.
Now, how long were you on patrol before you got promoted to sergeant?
I went to the 110 in 94, and I got promoted in March of 2001.
And what was your first command as a sergeant?
Well, I had a little leeway in between because I was on the sergeant's list. I don't know if the PD still does this. They used to take, if you were on the sergeant's list and they needed somebody at a temporary assignment, it used to be narcotics. Everybody used to dread, I'm going to become sergeant. They're going to send me narcotics. They always talked about the guy who got jammed up while he was in narcotics waiting to be sergeant. So right. That's always in the back of everybody's mind. I don't want to get jammed up. So I'm in the 110 one day, and then they're like, you got transferred free. So I'm like, yeah, sure, whatever. I've been here 7 years. I'm like, I'm making boss next year. They're like, no, you're going to the OMAP unit. I'm like, I never heard of that place. So, and like three people said it, but you know, cop humor is I'm like, they're playing a joke on me. I know.
Right. You think they're pulling your leg?
Yeah. So this one rookie who I never talked to before, she's like, oh, are you Fariso? I go, yeah. She goes, I took your calls and the telephone message. I'm like, oh, fuck, I got transferred. I go, this doesn't make any sense. I'm not a boss yet. So I'm like, did I get promoted and they didn't tell me? So I went to the OMAP unit. It was a long story, but basically we were doing data entry and they sent us there because we were on the sergeant's list. And, you know, after I'm retired now, I could say it. The NYPD loves to hold something over your head. And what it was yep. Nobody wanted to be in this unit. It had a lot of sensitive information that we had to transcribe into the computer. So they basically said, if you give out this sensitive information, you're never getting promoted. So everybody's like, okay, I guess we're just going to type, not say anything. And it had to do with the questionable shooting in the Bronx. And we had a 250s and it was a whole project. And then I got promoted out there and I went to the 13th precinct. It was, I went to Manhattan, you know, I was a Queens guy, but everybody in the 110 used to, not everybody, guys in the 110 would joke with me. They go, you're going to make sergeant. You're going to be the 7-5 midnight sergeant. So I'm like, I ain't going to be the 7-5 midnight sergeant. They're like, Fariso, you're going to the 7-5. So I'm like, well, I don't have a hook. There's a chance this could happen. So I got promoted. I went to the 13th. So it could have been a lot worse. So 13th wasn't a bad command. Wasn't dead, but it was not busy. It was like a cross between Lower Manhattan and Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah, it's for people that don't know, I think it's on 19th Street because the police academy is right around the corner on 20th Street between 2nd and 3rd. It's there's money down there. It's a good, for a cop, you're going to eat well. You're not going to be racing around. It's not like the Bronx, Queens, or Brooklyn. You got to mind your P's and Q's. You can get civilian complaints very easily. You can piss off someone influential very easily and find yourself at the ass end of Brooklyn or Staten Island. So it's a different mindset working in the 13th precinct than from the 110 or up in the Bronx. So after that, shifting gears, you wind up in the Internal Affairs Bureau, but let me just explain to our listeners. When John and I got hired, the Internal Affairs Bureau were career guys. It was the land of misfit toys, the Charlie in a box, the train with square wheels. It was guys that literally, and women, that were afraid of the street. They went into IAB, and your career was over. And they didn't have a lot of friends. And you wouldn't go to a barbecue at another cop's house, and someone would say, oh, that's my brother-in-law. He works in internal affairs. Like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. Like, I mean, that's how bad it was. But the one thing the NYPD did, one of a few things they did really well, was in the 90s, they figured out, we've got all this deadwood in IAB. They're basically useless. Let's start bringing in seasoned cops and investigators, sharp guys. We'll get more with these guys, and we'll do away with the nitpicking. Well, they thought that in theory. So what they did was, when you would put in, so say you become a sergeant, and you do your time in a precinct, and you say, you know what, I want to go to narcotics, I want to go to vice, I want to go to the auto crime division. You do an interview, an OCCB, organized crime interview. But now what they did was they put IAB at the table. So it's like the NFL draft. You do your interview and there's a guy from vice, there's a lieutenant from vice, there's a captain from auto crime. And from what I remember, IAB would always have a couple of first round draft picks. So say somebody like me, if I got promoted to sergeant and I was an auto crime detective first, they'd want me because for insurance fraud. Like, you know, I'm sure there's cops that burn their cars or commit insurance fraud with their cars. This guy knows exactly how to do it. I would get grabbed. I would do my 2 years as a sergeant. Is it two? 2 years in narcotics.
Yeah, it's two years.
Internal affairs. And then, in theory, you could work wherever you wanted within reason. So you got drafted in IEB. What was that like for you?
Well, what happened was I always wanted to be a detective. So ironically, I made sergeant. So I kind of missed the detective rank. So when you're a detective and you're a sergeant, then you become sergeant, IEB just pulls you. And it's kind of, a lot of guys know they're going. So I was putting in for different units. And, you know, basically I was being told on the side, John, you have no investigative experience. They're not taking you. So as time went by, I said, I got to make a decision. I want to go to the squad. I've been on patrol. You know, I've done my years on patrol. And when you're a sergeant on patrol, you become the fifth or sixth sector. You're doing a supervisor's duties and you're doing patrol. So I was like, listen, I'm burning the candle at both ends here. So I put in for what's called career path. And for your listeners who are not, you know, law enforcement, career path is exactly what you said. There's like five units and IEB is the one. Now, some people will never put in for a transfer because they're terrified of going there. And I get it. I totally get it. But I really had to make that decision and say, am I willing to take this chance? Excuse me?
It's worth the risk.
Some guys won't take it. They really don't. And I get it. But I had 10 years on and I'm like, all right, I'm going for this. I'm going to go for this career path. So a lot of people told me I was crazy. John, you're crazy. Do not put in for career path. I was like, well, what am I going to do? Work in the barriers section? Maybe get task force? I'm not knocking that. Well, listen, man. I'm writing a book. That's number one. I'm writing a book. So nobody knew that, but I'm like, I'm writing a book here. And I had a heck of a lot of experience as a sergeant on patrol. And I'm like, I have more experience than this. I got to move on. So my lieutenant's like, if you put in for career path, you're going to IEB, John. I'm like, just sign my papers. I'm going wherever they go. So I go to the meeting and there's five captains there. And these are Florida captains.
And there's one captain. Yeah, I did it.
John, tell me all about yourself. John, tell me about yourself. So it's obvious that one captain was internal affairs. So I go back to the commands and I'm in the 13th and a cop comes up to me and goes, I heard you're going to internal affairs. I'm like, what? So I'm like, how do you know I'm going to internal affairs? I go, I don't know what you're talking about. So I leave. So another guy comes up to me. Hey, when you get to IEB, let me know what it's like. I'm thinking of going. I'm like, what is going on here? I just went on this freaking career path interview. So I go home and I tell my wife. I said, listen, the rumor mill is already spinning. So I'm going to be hearing about this. I don't know where this is going, but everybody's telling me I'm going to IEB. All I did was go on an interview with five captains. So I kid you not, it's 100% true. About 2 days later, my phone rings. It's a friend of mine who's not on the job. He goes, John, what's going on? Are you going to internal affairs? So I go, what are you talking about? So he goes, I just got a phone call from so-and-so. So I did my detective skills. I know somebody talked to somebody who's talked to somebody. Because, right. You know, with Queens, everybody knows a cop. So I go back to the office and I'm like, I don't know what's going on. So I got another heads up down the line. I'm like, all right, I guess this transfer is going to come through. And sure enough, they transferred me on like a Friday at like 4 o'clock. Because I'm assuming that was strategic because they don't want everybody.
Of course it is. So you can't do anything about it.
Yeah. Well, they don't want everybody harassing the daylights out of you. So
that's true.
You know, I said goodbye to a few guys and I said, listen, a couple of guys came up to me on the side and they're like, hey, John, we'll be seeing you again soon. You're doing. It was like I was going off to war or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I remembered my first day and I'm like, I knew zero about internal affairs. I never expected to be there. But, you know, I was being realistic. It's a big police department, 30,000 people. You need structure. You need somebody to enforce rules. I mean, I had seen cops get jammed up and I saw cops that didn't do anything. And I saw cops that,
deserved it. They had it coming.
So I'm being realistic. So I got called to the command center, which was ironically where everybody gets GO-15'd or they get PG'd. For your non-law enforcement is basically it's a department trial, non-criminal. And everybody used to joke around, oh, if you're going to Hudson Street, oh my Lord, you're going to Hudson. I used to always hear Hudson Street, Hudson Street. Sure enough, I'm going to Hudson Street. So I don't think much of this. So I walk down the hallway and I'm waiting for like this major office with all these high-tech computers and all. Yeah, you already see where this is going. So there's a big glass door, and the glass door, anyone who's been in Hudson Street knows what I'm talking about. So now I'm not going there to get PG'd or GO'd. I'm going there to work. And I see guys in the hallway, and I'm like, oh, please, I hope I don't see somebody I know. So I get to the glass door, and I knock on it, and I said, I'm Sergeant Free, so I'm here for my first day. The guy comes up to me, goes, I don't care what anybody says. He goes, you're still a rookie. You did this now. He goes, I got 19 years on, and I'm here. I wish I did this when I had 10 years on. I'm like, okay, that kind of makes sense to me, so that's not that bad. So I go in the office, and the guy goes to me, he goes, this is the command center. He goes, basically, when someone makes an allegation, which could be a prisoner, a family member, a perp, another cop, they call this the 1-800-PRIDE-PD. I was the guy on the
line. So you got the action desk.
Oh, yeah, the action desk. But there's a lot more going on there. And I don't know if this is still done, but I got somehow roped into dealing with the 911 calls, because what would happen is these perps would, like, narcotics were notorious for this, just like grabbing sets of people and throwing them against the wall and searching them. And maybe a guy doesn't get locked up out of the crowd, and he goes to the payphone and he starts yelling about the cops and the R&P number. And the dispatcher is like, I guess they're trained to just put it through the IB. So I'm picking up the phone and I hear a guy yelling, I'm on the corner, I'm on this street, they threw me. I'm like, slow down. He's like, what the F, you don't want to talk to me? And I'm like, you know this is internal affairs. He goes, oh. And then the whole conversation would change. But some of the perps didn't even want to talk to IB. They were freaked out. They were like, even the prisoners were like, oh shit, this is IAB? I'm not talking to you guys. I'm like, okay, goodbye.
Yeah, they want to get civilian complaint review board.
Probably. Or they would just, I really believe, and I'll say this, is that IAB puts a tremendous amount of resources into an allegation. So it's not like some bullcrap robbery. If a bullcrap robbery happens, but if there's a bullcrap robbery and a cop's involved, you will see the amount of resources put into this. Because I would field this call and I would take the statement. You had to take every word. And they had a list of who called when and everything. And then even though I was a sergeant, I had to bring it up to the supervisor. I would say, listen, Sarge, there's a guy on the phone and he's basically saying two cops put a gun to him and stole his $1,000. So that's obviously got to be looked at. They would put a tremendous amount of resources into that. Now, this is where cops need to hear this. Now, I've been at IAB for 15 years, but almost every cop gets cleared because they're prisoners. They're lying. They're making it up. It never happened. Retaliation. Or they were never cops. These guys just got straight up robbed in the street, and they're saying they were cops because they believed they were. So
didn't IAB have a criminal impersonation unit?
They do, but because what happened a lot of times, these guys would describe, and I would say, what was the cop wearing? What was this? And they were like, they would mention a bullshit firearm. They would mention so much stuff that was like very TV related. I'm like, these weren't cops. What was their shield number? 6. I'm like, no, this is no. I'm like, you got robbed. So they would have an impersonation unit. So then I would take the report and I would put it in that, this looks like an impersonation, whatever. And then there would be decisions we made. Let me tell you, when you want to talk about something that goes up the ladder, that went up the ladder. And then the impersonation unit would go out. And quite often it was just a ripoff crew and drugs and everything related. And they did that. Now, at the command center, I dealt with everything from a lost parking plaque to straight up homicide. And I saw everything in between. I'm telling you, I was amazed at the stuff that came through that office. I was amazed at the allegations. And there was a few things that everybody in IAB had a pretty good sense of humor. Because when I got there the first day, they had a giant cheese head behind me. Like, you know, the cheese head they wear at the games?
Yeah.
So they would kind of like joke around that they were, you know, cheese eaters. Because they knew we would call us cheesies. And I would call desks and I'd be like, the 120, I need, this is a command center. And the effing phone would go silent. It was like, whoa, the IAB's calling. And because a lot of times I would get prisoners, sometimes would call from the precinct, which is unbelievable that they would. So we would have to investigate it. And, you know, the complaint went up the rank. And then sometimes I didn't see the end of the investigation because it went to another unit. It's like a squad where they would
Yeah, different groups, right? Different groups handle different things.
Yes, they had the impersonation and they had different groups. So they would basically, if it happened in a strange area, Queens, really like obscure on the Rockaways, the guys out in the Rockaways would deal with it. So we would send it and they would, you want to talk about going out immediate? There was no, like in a squad where, okay, here's the case, we'll put it here. These guys went out within the hour. They had boots
on the ground. Tell you, I mean, so when boots I worked in organized crime and auto crime, unfortunately, we had to call them a couple of times because especially, I've said this and I would have never believed it when I was on patrol. I would have never believed it. I had that locker room mindset of, IEB, they're a bunch of fuck ups. And you go to organized crime, right? You start going on wiretaps and you start dealing with upper echelon informants. And I'm telling you, every time we did a wiretap, a cop or two wandered onto the playing field. And we did one case where we had guys shipping cars out of the country. And the guys that were stealing the cars for the shippers were doing hits. They were doing homicides. Uh-huh. And there were a couple of cops from a Bronx precinct that were running plates for them to go out and steal cars. So if they saw a nice car they wanted to steal, they'd call up their buddies. And their buddies would run the plate for them. And these two cops were slick. What they would do is, and you'd understand this, so they wouldn't run the plate in their own mobile digital terminal. What they would do is they'd show up on a job. So say for argument's sake, me and you were working together and we're on the 20th floor of a building. They'll show up and they'll go, oh, John, let me borrow the keys to your car. I got to get a 61 out of your car. They'd go down to your car, turn your car around, run the plate, because they almost got a bunch of cops in this precinct jammed up until we figured it out, because IEB was going to burn a lot. And we're like, no, we know what they're doing. But a couple of times, and the last case I worked on, there was a cop from Queens, and he was involved in a hijacking and a home invasion, and he was also doing high-level burglaries out in the Hamptons. He had a friend that was a realtor. And the realtor would tip him off to nice houses when the families were out for the summer or something, and this guy would go back into the house and break into him. So, you're right. I mean, I would never have believed it, but from time to time, there's cops doing outrageous shit that you would never imagine. The problem I have with IEB, though, is, you know what? Bad cops, go get them. I always had the problem with those fucking integrity tests. Because I had one happen to me. I was driving the sergeant in the 5-0, and these two women dressed as homeless people came up to me with a shopping cart with a shotgun in it. And they said, "We found this." And the shoes were wrong. Everything about they were too clean and the shoes were wrong on the both of them. And I said, "I'll tell you what." I says, "When I vouch for this," I said, "tell your friends from IEB to come and they can pick up the voucher." And they got pissed. They're giving me dirty looks. And an hour later, a lieutenant from IEB came and picked up the voucher. So they'll do, you know this. They do these integrity tests where they try setting cops up to take bait on something.
Yeah, there's a unit that does that. And they're very secretive. Like when I was in IEB, I worked not only command center, I did the force unit. And I don't know what it's like now. I mean, it's probably changed in some ways. But there's a lot going on, and a lot of these places don't talk to each other. So they had a unit that did that, and how they targeted and why, I was never privy to that. But those things exist. And in a strange way, it does keep, I guess, the department in line on some guys that would maybe think about doing something and wouldn't for that reason. And I remembered as a rookie, everybody's like, search the back of the car. They're going to put something in it. I'm like, okay. So, yeah. Those things, there's a lot going on, and there people have those stories,
Well, a lot of the calls into the action desk at IEB, like husband and wives, ex-boyfriend and girlfriend, or other cops, like so some sergeant takes a guy out of his detail and he's trying to get back at the guy. I mean, did you get a lot of that?
Yeah, going to the cops, it's very rare. And I got very good at noting when a cop was calling something in, because we have an interesting way of wording things. Because when it did happen, which was rare, I would tell the investigator, this might be a cop that called this in. Like, we had one once where a camera was found, and this is one of the cases when it was a big case. I only had the very beginning of it. Basically, I got a letter sent to me. There was a camera found, and what was on the camera was some type of child pornography. And I'm like, I know a cop found this camera in the precinct, and I just basically I didn't even see the pictures. I didn't want to.
Yeah,
I didn't download it. I gave it to the other unit who downloads it, and they came back to me. They were like, it's legit. Someone's getting locked up. I was like, whoa. And that was fast. So I always felt that I could kind of tell when a cop
was a cop? Something.
Oh, it was a cop in those pictures, yeah. No, but I felt that a cop had found this camera and said, oh, shit, what is this? And that's just the opinion I got from the brief investigation I did. And it was legit. And they locked the guy up. But I wasn't part of the arrest. I wasn't part of that part of the investigation. The command said they had the very beginning of the investigation, and they put it off. There was a lot of calls when, like, spouses that were not happy with each other and knew how to drop dimes. And you got to wonder how they knew it. But, you know, somebody would call up, my husband's no good. You're like, whatever. We hear this all day. And then they should be like, well, he's dating a drug dealer. You're like, okay. So, you know, that's considered association. So you should know better. If you're a guy, you can't date a drug dealer. And you shouldn't be telling your girlfriend either, your other girlfriend.
I heard a story.
Yeah, we got those cases.
I heard a story. There was a cop up in upstate New York, and him and the wife were going through a divorce, and he was cleaning his gun years before, and there was an accidental discharge in the house. So the guy was handy, and he plugged up the hole in the wall. He didn't cut the sheetrock and retrieve the round, and she called up. She got the house and the divorce. She says he shot a hole in the wall, and the IB went up there and cut out the sheetrock and saw on the other side there was a hole through it, retrieved the round, and came back to his gun, and he got one stuck in his ass for failure to report. You know, it's... Yeah.
That's probably not even an IAB case. That got knocked down. That even IAB would be like, yeah, you made a mistake, but they dealt with more criminal stuff, like with the parking plaques and stuff. But, you know, IAB, we had our share of humor there too, because we're dealing with really bad perps, because they know the system. And I wrote about this story in my book. It's called Stop Calling 911. Or you shouldn't have called 911. So what happened was, the guy, while he was getting arrested, was saying they didn't think these were cops. And it was narcotics. They were locking him up. And I could hear them, like, fighting with him in the closet. So I get the narcotics guy on the phone. And I'm like, yeah, he called internal affairs. The narcotics guys identified themselves. All right, no association. There's no impersonation, nothing. So then the guy calls me back like 20 minutes later. He's like, they're harassing me, these cops. So I'm like, why? He's like, because I called you. Now they won't let me out. I'm like, let you out? You're dealing from your house. So then I'm like, hold on. I still have to look into this. So I went to my computer. The guy had been arrested 8 times in like a year. So I called the guy back. I called the squad. I said, put them back on the phone. This is internal affairs. I said, you cannot get let go. You've been arrested 8 times. So he's like, okay, all right, fine. So I hang up the phone. I think I forgot the guy. The guy starts calling me from Central Booking. And I'm like, now he's calling me from the payphone in Central Booking. And he's got my name. And I'm like, why are you calling me? Oh. And he's like, you know what I'm going to do? And I'm like, what are you going to do? And I'm like, listen, go see the judge. I can't deal with you anymore. He's like, I'm going to take a cop's gun and I'm going to have him kill me. So I'm like, why would you call me up and say that? He's like, I'm going to take a cop's gun from here and I want them to kill me. So I'm like, really? You're going to do that? Okay. I hang up the phone on the guy, call the desk officer in Central Booking. Listen, you got a suicide by cop going on in your command right now. So he's like, really? So I said, you got to call me back with the disposition because I got to close this case. It's not an IAB case, but I still got to close it because I'm responsible for this idiot now. Like 20 minutes later, ESU's bagging the guy up. And I'm talking to the lieutenant, and I hear the yelling and screaming in Central Booking in the gates, and I hear the guy yelling and screaming while he's in the bag.
You know, John, it's funny because people won't realize this, but you want to find a grumpy son of a bitch, it's usually the sergeant working in Bronx Central Booking in the intake, because those poor guys, they either got jammed up or they're just looking to ride out their retirement, and you're sitting behind a desk and hundreds, if not thousands, of arrests are passing through there, a sea of humanity, and you got prisoners that want to go to the hospital, prisoners making allegations, all sorts of shit. The only probably person that would get that guy off his ass, that supervisor, was a call from a sergeant from internal affairs that he was oh shit. Anyone else calls up, yeah, okay, and they'll hang up the phone. That was probably the one call that would wake that guy up that night. And rightfully so, if that guy, if that, you know, that was the mindset of that perp.
And, you know, even though I was in internal affairs, I'm still a cop. You know, he's calling suicide by cop. And
oh, God forbid. Right. You can't have that on your conscience if, God forbid, you didn't do anything about it. And
part of me's like, if this goes south here, I'm never getting out of IEB. I'm going to be stuck here. I'm like, I got to straighten this out. So it was not an IEB case and I got it. But what's funny is, like you mentioned, Central Booking. When I was in the force unit later on, I left the command center. I went to the force unit. We used to get, like, prisoners would just drop dead in the cells. They would just straight up eat drugs.
That's bad for business.
Like,
that's bad.
Yeah, it's like time to see the judge. Wake up, Johnny. Wake up, Johnny. And they would call us. They go, we got a guy just dead in the cells. So then I would have to go and interview the prisoners and the cell attendants and everything. And it was a long process. And
well, it's basically a crime scene.
Yes. Usually it had to do with eating drugs, basically. Somehow these guys, I think they would eat drugs. I didn't do narcotics, but I'm sure they did that. And then they would get to the cells and just drop.
What happened if a guy's dealing, right? And say, for argument's sake, he's got a couple of decks of heroin and they didn't find it. So when they locked him up for sale and he probably had the whatever he had on him very well hidden, or the cop just didn't find it. And they know going into corrections, they're really going to search the shit out of him, because corrections does a better job than we do searching prisons, because that's all they do all day long. And they're like, fuck, I'm going to go into corrections. They're going to find it and I'm going to get another charge on me. Or they're a junkie and they think they can handle it. Yeah. And like you said, instead of doing two bags of dope, he does four. And the next thing you know, especially now with fentanyl, his heart's going to stop.
Yeah, they used to drop dead in the back of the van, too. That we used to call it the P van.
Oh, the P van. Yeah, I worked in narcotics.
Narcotics. I will give a shout out to narcotics. These guys knew how to tell a story. They knew how to articulate. They were very good at telling the story. Now, I'm not saying they were telling exactly how it happened. Listen, I put the guy in the van. I don't know what happened. You know, they had dealt with so many court cases and everything. And whenever I had to interview a narcotics guy, I knew that I was going to get the story correct very quickly. Because I could talk to rookies. It was very hard to get a story out of them. And
they'll hang themselves.
Well, that's a problem, too. Sometimes you're like, get the delegate here. But ironically, ESU were the worst to interview. The worst. These ESU guys went into this whole scenario about the tech plan and the wall and the corners. I would actually tell the ESU sergeant, listen, if he starts going off in a deep end about something else, I'm pausing the tape and we're going back to reality, because I can't be here all day about a tack plan. I get it. Give me the tack plan. I'll put it in the case file, but you can't explain it all day long. So
each unit, like I was saying, well, the NYPD is so compartmentalized, and you're right. Different units are known for different things, different mindsets. ESU is totally different than narcotics guys, through vice guys and auto crime. So, John, again, tell us the name of your book and where my listeners can find it.
Yes. All in a Day's Work, An Officer Counts, 20 Years NYPD.
And it's available on Amazon?
Yes, and Amazon Kindle.
And John, in addition to being an author, you're also a licensed private investigator in New York State. Could you tell us what type of cases you handle, and if someone's out there in need of a private investigator in the New York City area, where they can get a hold of you?
I started at the Missing Person Squad, and I was getting fielded with a lot of missing person questions after I retired from other private eyes, cops, guys I network with. And I was giving them a wealth of information. And then I was like, you know, I'm not in missing persons anymore. They're like, Bob, but you lived it for 5 years. You know these cases. So I got the private eye business. And I said to myself, John, do not do domestic violence cases. Don't do cheating spouses. Don't get involved in that. Because the headaches that I talk to with guys, I don't do those cases. And the dysfunctionalism on those cases is, I'm talking when I know guys who have private eye cases and the husband's telling the wife, well, my PI, I just got off the phone with them. So they're like giving you up to the other family member who they actually have a case against. It's too much aggravation. You got to be in crappy hotels late at night. So I don't do the domestic violence cases or that stuff. But so basically, I still do missing person cases. And what happened was, I was getting contacted by nonprofit organizations that are doing cold cases. So what happens is, there's a lot of online sleuths out there now. And I will say, you could do it. I could do a whole show on this. I'm not a fan. There's some of them that are really good. And I know when I find one, when one's good. But the thing is, they uncover stuff. And, you know, they're uncovering things about cases that 30 years ago were not done. And I'm like, and they present it. And I'm like, they got a point on this. So I'll contact the family. And this is all nonprofit. I don't get paid. And I'll contact the family. And a lot of these cases are homicides. And I will at least help the family out to get the ball rolling. So I have two cases I worked on. One I got reopened through the NYPD. And I'm hoping it goes where I'm expecting. And the other one, they're close to making an arrest out of state on basically some real mistakes were made by a small police department years ago. And the family's now talking, and I was able to interview the family. And I present it to the police department. I say, listen, I'm retired. I think you should go criminally with this. And I present it. And sometimes they don't, you know, listen, I don't care if you were private. Once PD, you're a private eye. We're not doing this. And other times I just handed them a basket of what they've been looking for. So basically, I'm still doing missing person cases after I retired.
And what's the name of your private investigative firm, and where can people get a hold of you?
Yes, Ferris Investigations. And you can find me at my website. You go on the website, it'll show you what I do. I do missing person cases almost exclusively. There are other cases I'll take, and they could reach out to me, anybody, with an email and through there. And if there's a department, a police department that has a case and they have a question, I get a lot of law enforcement guys or retired guys who are doing it, and they're stuck on a missing person case, because guys will be honest with me. They're like, listen, I don't do missing person cases. I don't know really what I should do here. And I'll kind of school them on what should be done. And, you know, a lot of times it's as simple as there's a lot of crystal meth in other states. And, you know, it's sad to say, but guys are just they're just binging and they're running into the woods or into the desert. And I'm kind of gotten pretty good at telling some of these investigators where they need to look. And I've had a few cases where the body was found very close to where I said it was.
One last time, what's the name of your book and where people can find it?
Yes. All in a Day's Work, an Officer's Accounts, 20 Years, NYPD. You can find it on Amazon. And my private eye firm is called Ferris Investigations. You can find me at ferrisinvestigations.org online.
John Fariso, thank you again for spending some time with us today. And as always, I want to thank everyone for tuning in, especially my friends in Charlotte, North Carolina, Wappinger Falls, New York, former home of Tawana Brawley, New York, Lindbergh, New York, Rahmer, Alabama, Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Pearl River, New York. If you work in law enforcement or have an interesting criminal background or would like to be a guest on the show, drop me a note on Twitter or Instagram at VicFerrari50. And again, if you've enjoyed the content, please check out my Amazon author page. Type in my name, Vic Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. Thank you again for tuning in, and I'll have another episode out next week.